All right, let's come to order and let me see who's here this evening. Katrina Bowles.
Here.
Greg.
Here.
John Conway.
Here.
Cody Darr.
Here.
I am here. Tony Grove.
Here.
Hedrick will not be joining us. Kimberly.
Here.
And Bill will not be joining us. So, we need to approve our agenda for tonight, July 19th. Review it. And offer any changes or corrections, if anybody has any.
Motion to approve, Madam Chairman.
I'll second.
Thank you. Approve?
Aye.
Great, thank you. I think we do not have a minute drafts for this meeting, right?
No.
Right. Okay. So we should have those for next time. All right. So, Tad, I think we're good to go.
I'll just sit here and drive. I'm going to be giving the presentation this evening. My name is Ryan Williams. I'm the Assistant Utilities Director for Water and Light. If you got any questions or anything during the presentation, just feel free to ask, and I'll do my best to answer them for you.
Is your background in electrical engineering?
Yes. I have an electrical engineering degree and a computer engineering degree from the University of Missouri. I've been with the utility here for 14 years. I've been the Assistant Director for Water and Light for over 5.
How is it working for Tad?
Can I ask Tad to leave the room, please?
Just kidding.
Sure. Tad's working. I'm going to kind of give you a zoom in and a zoom out of how, you know, kind of the electricity works in general throughout the city of Columbia. We'll zoom into the downtown area and kind of focus on that for a little bit, and then we'll zoom back out towards the end for some of the planning measures and efforts that we do, and then, you know, kind of, you know, at the end, kind of ask, you know, well, you know, what type of future should we be looking for? Kind of a historical perspective, we'll start here with Columbia Water and Light and funding. Traditionally, Columbia Water and Light has used a combination of bonds and rate revenues to fund large capital projects. Using bond revenues or borrowing money for large projects helps us align projects that have long lifetime spans, you know, things that last 30, 40, 50 years. It allows us to match the financial or financing of that particular item with the lifespan of that particular item, so that the people that are using or consuming that infrastructure are the ones that are paying for it as they go along. Historically, we've issued bonds. As you can see here, we've got 7 bonds that we have on record that we've issued in the past. And at different times, bonds haven't been needed because of, you know, either the growth rate or our rate revenues were capable of funding the projects that were needed during that particular time frame.
Out of those 4 at the bottom, which ones are still active?
We've done a lot of bond refinancing over the course of years, so I can't tell you exactly which ones we still currently have and which ones have been refinanced. You know, I believe that the all up until the 2015 have been refinanced into some newer, lower rate, while the 2015 series, I believe, stand on their own at this point in time.
Yeah, I guess if you take 25 years on 1983, so those are probably paid off. Probably the ones outstanding are probably the 2008, 11, and 15.
The 2011 was kind of a unique series of bond issues for us. We actually purchased the Columbia Energy Center. It was an opportunistic way to purchase additional capacity within our footprint. You know, the 2008 and 2015 bond issuance were for capital improvement projects, where the 2011 issuance was more of an opportunity to purchase capacity when they were previously owned by the Columbia Energy Center was previously owned by Ameren, and it gave us an opportunity to purchase that at a very opportune cost.
144 megawatts.
The 2015 bond was our most recent bond issue. You know, it had four major categories, including infrastructure, renew and replacement, a new transmission line in the southern portion of our electric service territory. It had some upgraded enhancements to our several of our systems and system modernization and some expansion as part of that particular process for the four broad categories that we had for that particular bond. As you guys are probably aware, the largest portion of that particular bond was for our new transmission line project and substation in the southern portion of our electric service territory. And that particular project is being reviewed at the council level at this particular time.
It really looks nice there, that rendering there of that lower right picture. How great those 161 kV transmission poles look, really great, fit right into landscape. And I bet if you, after time, you drive by there, you probably wouldn't even notice that they were there.
Unless you're an electrical engineer, you probably notice that.
Historically, looking at our growth, we've had, you know, growth rates from less than 1% to over 2% over the course of time, but usually it varies somewhere between 1% and 2%. Our current rate of growth is right around 1.25%. The city currently maintains a five-year capital improvement plan. Although on both the water and electric side, we're required to do some planning beyond that, not only for internal prudent practices, but there are several mandates, and we'll go over some of the regulatory bodies that we have to report to, that require us to do planning beyond the five-year horizon. Looking at, kind of more focusing in on the downtown area, the power plant was the original load center for the entire city of Columbia. From 1904 to 1961, it was the only source of electricity in town. Initially, when Water and Light started, the light part of Water and Light was we literally provided electric street lights at night. And so we would operate them from dusk until midnight, and then we would shut them off. It wasn't until sometimes later that we actually took on customers and began serving 24 hours a day. Our original distribution system was a 2,400-volt system. These came off of the direct generator buses at the power plant located down on the business loop. And then at some point in time, the city had grown to such a place where we needed to install our first, quote, transmission system. And at that point in time, the transmission system was at 13.8 kV. As you can see in this photo here, you know, we had four 13.8 kV substations where the power generator from the power plant stepped up to 13.8 kV, sent to these four stations, and then transformed back down to 2,400 volts.
Has it always been an alternating current system, or did it start out DC?
For us, it's always been an alternating.
Alternating.
So where are those red dots?
They're in the downtown area. I don't know specifically what streets they are, but I believe, you know, the power plant's here. You know, this would be Paris Road. This would probably be College Boulevard. You know, this would be down towards Stadium. You know, Broadway's probably this line in the middle. I'm not sure what this western.
West Boulevard.
Is it west or?
Could be West Boulevard, yeah. I think that's probably right. And the province is probably right through here. So it's kind of the more core area. Certainly, our system has grown a lot larger than that. We'll look at it here in just a minute. Kind of going through a brief history of how our power supply has evolved over to its current state over the past few years. Like I mentioned before, until 1961, all of the power that was supplied to the city of Columbia was generated at the power plant, at the municipal power plant. In 1961, we signed a power purchase agreement with Central Electric Cooperative, and that was our first tie to the outside world. Moving on a little bit further in history, by the end of 1979, we were purchasing over half of our power from Union Electric, or what is now known as Ameren.
Is it just cheaper to buy it from the outside
sources? There's an economy of scale, yes. And so, you know, the larger power plants are more efficient and are able to generate energy at a cheaper rate than our plant is currently. And so there's an economy of scale that gets enjoyed by some of the larger power-producing agencies out there. And so it was definitely more beneficial for us at that time to purchase external power. As well, it gives us some redundancy and some diversity in our power portfolio. You know, not only do we have the option of importing off of the transmission system, we also have internal generation as well. And so that blend makes us allows us to function in several different ways. You know, one system can hedge the other system as far as pricing. From an electric reliability standpoint, it allows us, you know, diversity in making sure that our supply, all of our eggs aren't in one basket, so that if you have problems with one portion, not your entire electric supply will be impacted.
So since 1979, was that tied at all into the Callaway plant?
At that point in time, it was more of a slice of system type of contract where, you know, we had a set amount that they were supposed to provide from us. How they actually physically provided it to us was up to them to decide how to do that. I don't think we've ever had a contract specifically for Ameren Energy in any one particular unit of Ameren. It's always been a slice of system type of contract. Moving on a little bit further in history, in 1981, we began our power purchase agreement with the city of Sikeston, Missouri. We currently have a 66 megawatt power purchase agreement with the city.
The term on that agreement, does it have an expiration or is it ever greened after a period of time?
It's life of unit. And, okay. You know, what your definition of life of unit is and what my definition of life of unit is might vary, but I would assume that, you know, from the city's perspective, we would fight for rights to energy off of that until that unit was no longer in existence.
There was a number of municipals that went in on that 1981 deal. City of Columbia wasn't the only one, I believe.
That's correct. You know, there are several other cities that are also, including the city of Sikeston.
Right.
Yeah. Hasn't the way the market works for that changed a little bit? I mean,
it has. We'll go over that here in a little bit.
Yep.
Continuing on with some of our capacity purchases that make up our current capacity. In 2005, we did a power purchase agreement with Iatan 2. That was for 20 megawatts out of KCKNO. In 2006, we did a power purchase agreement with Prairie State for 225 megawatt shares of their energy campus. Like I mentioned before, in 2011, we did have that special bond issuance where we purchased the Columbia Energy Center, and that was for 144 megawatts of capacity, and that's located, you know, basically here in town. It's up by where the sanitary landfill is, up off of Peabody Road. There are four simple cycle turbines that are gas-fired. So what does that give us for 2016? If you add up all of our purchase power agreements and add up all of our local generation that we have, either at the municipal power plant or at the Columbia Energy Center, we have a total of 330 megawatts of capacity. In 2012, our peak was 267 megawatts. So as you can see, we currently have enough generation capacity to meet our load needs. And we'll talk a little bit about how to balance that a little bit further on going forward in the future here. Kind of from a very, very high level, if we want to look at the infographic at the top, you know, how energy is delivered to the end customer, you know, power plants are required to generate the electricity. Typically, they are sent across high voltage transmission lines. In the mid-Missouri area, there are three levels of high, what we consider high voltage or transmission level. That would be 345 kV, 161 kV, and 69 kV. From one of those voltage, there'll be a power substation where there are large station class transformers that step that voltage down to whatever distribution voltage. The particular utility uses, we happen to use 13.8 kV at this point in time. The utility then takes it and distributes it throughout town on the poles and through the underground system through the distribution lines towards the end customer. And then the end customer will have an end-use transformer stepping it down from 13.8 to whatever their end-use voltage is. You know, typically, residential is 120 or 240 volts. Traditional three-phase services that we offer are 120-208 and 480-277.
It was single-phase service in the residential neighborhood?
That's correct.
What voltage is that?
120-240.
The distribution?
Distribution, single-phase.
7970?
7,000?
7970.
Yep. Okay.
Our generation system, generation resources have to be matched to the amount of load that you have. Going from the previous slide, you know, we have a little bit of a margin, and we're actually required to keep, I believe at this point in time, a 14% margin by our MISO, which is our Mid-Continent Independent System Operator. They're the ones that kind of have the day in, day out, watching over our back type of thing to make sure that we're operating our portion of the electric system reliably. They also have the responsibility of making sure that for the entire MISO region, there's enough generation to match the load. So they require us to have a 14% margin. So in theory,
is it spinning, or is it
just capacity margin?
Capacity margin, so it's not spinning.
It doesn't have to be spinning.
Okay.
And so,
right. I have a feeling that we have a very wide range of knowledge about this in here. So, could we maybe give a little bit more background on some of that? Like, I don't know what 7970 and
7,970 volts is okay. The single phase primary distribution voltage. It's basically the square root of 3 of the
13.8.
And the group you were saying, the Mid-Continental Group, is that a federal agency or?
They are our regional transmission organization. They act as our reliability coordinator. And what they do is they offer several services. They are the one that actually facilitate the energy market that we participate in. And so on a daily basis, we bid in our load, you know, whichever load we want to expose to the market. And then offering our generation. They will award the amount of generation to match our load, and they will let us know what that rate would be to look at it the day ahead, what it costs to meet your load for the following day. And then as the day progresses, they'll go through a real time, and they will dispatch the cheapest set of energy generation resources first, so that the entire region is dispatched as economically as possible. And so when the amount of generation equals, you know, they will rank up the cheapest generator first. When it exceeds, you know, when it gets at its maximum, they will move on to the next cheapest generator, and then the price for that, the real-time price for that, jumps to whatever the price for that next generator is. It will ramp up, and then, you know, eventually, if they get to you, you know, then you're the price setter for the locational marginal pricing at that point in time. They will ramp you up to your maximum and then move on to the next one. They also are the regional transmission organization, and so they watch over the transmission system, basically 100 kV and above for the regional area. MISO's regional area is roughly the middle third of the United States. They actually have some regions up in Canada, north coming down through Minnesota, Illinois, coming down through Missouri. They extend all the way down to Louisiana now. And there are different members in there. You know, we are one of maybe a dozen or two dozen members of the Midwest ISO that when they counted ISO now, they changed it. But that facilitate that energy market. And so since 2005, we've been a participant in their energy market. Since that time, they've brought out some additional markets. They have a capacity market that they now have. And there's also some other ancillary markets for like spending reserves, non-spending reserves. We don't really take advantage of that. We really don't have the equipment to really play in that particular market. So our main focuses are, you know, making sure that we have capacity credits to cover our load within the MISO market, and then we participate in their energy market every single day.
It's a non-profit entity. I mean, they're revenue neutral. They cover all their expenses and costs, and sure, all the money gets redistributed.
Sure. You been there?
Yeah, but they cover all their costs.
They do.
So it's not really a profit center, but they do cover all their costs to operate their system.
Comfortably.
Yes.
Yeah.
We do get revenues from them for things other than energy. You know, our portion of the transmission system, it used to be in the old world before the energy market, you know, there would be point-to-point and tags across and through each particular portion of the electric system, and people would actually have to reserve rights to determine wheel energy across your system. You know, at that particular time, we were basically just utilizing our system for ourselves. Now that we're a portion of the energy market, they're actually able to track minute portions of energy that does track across our system, and we do receive revenue for that energy wheeling across our system.
For example, we used to purchase transmission capacity through the city for the university to purchase electricity in the market. Now we're also participants in this MISO system. So we pay MISO, who then pays the city for the same transmission access.
Moving down a level here, the transmission system. For the city of Columbia, you know, our portion of the transmission system that's above 100 kV is at the 161 kV level. That's where the bulk of our power gets imported from. It's regulated by two main bodies, FERC, which is the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, and NERC, which is the North American Electric Reliability Corporation. NERC is actually kind of the enforcement arm for FERC. FERC is the kind of the federal body of regulators that's in charge of energy regulation throughout the United States. NERC's focus is mainly the reliability of the electric system within North America, and they're the ones that develop the regulations for the transmission system, and they deal with everything from, you know, operations, emergency operations, you know, load and energy balance, you know, personnel standards, maintenance standards, relaying standards, and other aspects of the bulk electric system, which is generally considered to be 100 kV and above. And kind of moving one level down from that, we do operate a 69 kV system. We operate it as if it were part of the bulk electric system for two main reasons. We use it as a reliability ring that services the bulk of our load throughout the city. And two, there are two other entities that get their access to the bulk electric system through our 69 kV system, one of them being the University of Missouri and another one being the City of Fulton. Both of them access the grid, if you will, through our 69 kV system.
Does NERC ever do an audit?
What's that?
Does NERC ever do an audit?
Yes, we have a NERC audit once every 3 years, and our next one is this September, so our staff is gearing up for that. It's typically a 3 or 4 day process where they'll come in, review our documentation on how well we've done in meeting the standards that they're coming to look at. They never come and look at all of the standards. If they were going to do that, they'd have to be here for like a month. There are, you know, when we started off, there was maybe, you know, a booklet of maybe that thick of standards, and now the amount of standards is a pile of papers about that tall. Heavy in the standard development over the past couple of years are standards that involve cybersecurity and how secure are your computer systems. that operate and monitor equipment that's at the bulk electric system level. We recently had to do an energy management system upgrade. In fact, we just completed that this year in order to be compliant with some of the new cybersecurity standards that are now enforceable as of July 1st of this year. So if we could let you upstairs, which we can no longer do, you would see that we have a brand new system. I've got a screenshot of it, but it's far enough out that it doesn't convey any critical cyber information. So you'll see that in a little bit.
So the cost to get that, was that known? Did you know that was coming? Is that something you could like work into your budget, or is it, are these standards that come along, are they relatively?
It's challenging sometimes to deal with developing standards. They typically give you about a year and 6 months notice from the time it gets enacted to the time that it becomes enforceable. But for some standards, that time frame is much shorter. It just depends on what that particular standard is and what the threat is to the bulk electric system.
Is there any membership governance in that process?
As far as it's all through, FERC is, that's your congressman, so there would be your primary. But NERC does have user groups and standards development teams. We do get notifications and are, part of their notification groups. We don't currently have any active members participating in the standards development. That would be a full-time job for several people. We, unfortunately, are probably one of the smallest players in the bulk electric system. We own just a little over 30 miles of 161 kV equipped lines and have just very few 161 kV bulk electric system type equipment. But because we do, and we do operate that, we own it and operate it, we are required to meet these standards. We're just the right size to be large enough to require, access at that level to be able to feed the 267 megawatt load that the city actually is. That's not really feasible to supply that all from a 69 kV system. We're one of the smaller entities. So, our voice in NERC would be small.
Is it true that a part of the transmission line project was to maintain NERC compliance?
That's correct, and we'll go over some of that here in a little bit. I've got a slide that shows what our system looks like, and we'll review our system as well as some of the needs from a transmission perspective that we're working on. But finishing out this slide, our current distribution system is at 13.8 kV. That is typically we have substation class transformers. Most of our substations, we have two of them. It's for a redundant purpose so that if one of them goes bad, we can take some power off of the other one and be able to feed the circuits that the one that failed was able to supply. Typically, we have three feeders, and those are individual circuits coming out. Individual distribution circuits coming out of the community off of each transformer.
So that would be like three residential homes?
No, that would be like three neighborhoods, if you will, three different type of neighborhoods.
So my little teeny stretch of homes is like six, 7 miles. It seems like everyone's got a transformer in the backyard.
That's your individual, that transforms the power from the distribution system voltage, which is this 13.8 kV. Down to your user end level, which is probably 120.
But the one at the end that always blows, all seven of us lose power.
That's an inline fuse for the particular circuit that you're on. And so, we have our protection philosophy for the distribution system uses a couple of different methods and protection schemes. The first is a high-speed breaker at the substation level. And so when there is a fault on the line, and that could be, you know, a stick that falls across the line. It could be an animal. Wind knocks over a pole. You can go over several different reasons that might cause a particular outage. But when there's a short circuit on the line itself, the way that our relays are programmed at the substation level, it's going to blink. It's going to open the line really quick, hoping that whatever got across the line burns off. And that is usually successful around 60 to 65% of the time, that whatever came in contact will burn up. And so then it'll close back, and that's when you see the little blinking of the lights. Now, our relays are programmed with three automatic reclose shots. So what you probably will see in a normal outage is the line will blink and it'll come right back on. And then if the fault is still on the line, it'll go back on, and it'll wait maybe 15 seconds is what it's programmed for. Come back on for a second. If the fault is still there, it'll cut back off, wait 30 seconds, come back on. If the fault is still there, it will cut off. Now, during that time, there are also inline fuses in our distribution system. And so if the fault is in off of one of our distribution feeder circuits on a service lateral, which would be like the 7 or 10 ohms or an entire street, half a block, depending on the needs. But that'll have a fuse, and so if the fault is in that particular area, you'll see that first blink, but that first blink is just to burn that. If it doesn't make it in that fuse at the entrance to your service ladder will blow, so those 7 people will be out of power, if you will, but the rest of the circuit should come back on and isolate that. And so that's in an effort to try and minimize the number of customers that are actually impacted by an outage. Now, several times, we do get an impact to the main distribution line feeder, which doesn't really have any fusing on it, except at going back to the substation where there's a circuit breaker, and that's where you get those three blinks, and then the entire circuit is out until we discover what the problem is and have a chance to make a repair.
Did not know that. That's awesome. Thank you.
You're welcome. This is the current configuration of our system. Kind of going back to that previous chart, talking about generation. As you know, we've got our power plant, which is located off of the business loop, and then up at our. Let me get a laser pointer out here. Up at our Bolstead substation, that's where the Columbia Energy Center is, and so those are our two sources of generation in town. We've got the Columbia Energy Center, which is attached to our Bolstead substation, and then the power plant, which is off of the business loop. The 161 kV system, which is where the bulk of our imports come from, is outlined in black. And as you can see, we own from our Bolstead substation coming down the east side of town, goes through our Rebel Hill substation. And currently, Rebel Hill is our only substation that takes the 161 kV level and steps it directly down to the distribution voltage of 13.8. Going through there, it comes through our Grindstone substation and then heading on south down and then finally ends at Central Electric's Boone substation. We also own a line to the west at the 161 kV level. It comes from our Perchy Creek substation, heads west across the river to Ameren's Overton substation. And then we actually own a little portion of line at the 161 kV level from Central Electric's McBain substation to an Ameren line that connects the Overton substation to, I believe, Lloyd Martin substation. And so that represents the 161 kV or bulk electric system that we own. We have 8 substations. As you can see here, these are these big black dots. Both of them, we have some at the 161 kV level, some at the 69 kV level. Moving down to that 69 kV level, we have 5 161 to 69 kV transformers. We have 2 of them at Perchy Creek, 2 of them at Bolstead, and 1 of them at Grindstone. And they are what we use to establish the 69 kV ring that circles the city and that has several other substations attached to it. Throughout those 8 substations, we have a total of 20 transformers, and those are what we use to establish the 13.8 kV distribution system. Remember from the earlier slide, at one point in time, we had a 2400 volt system. The last of that system was retired in 2003. So it's kind of interesting to note that we had our 2400 volt system was almost 100 years old when we retired it.
Those electrons must have been really sharp.
Kind of more zooming in to the downtown area. For this particular presentation, I think we define downtown as being the area encompassed by the Business Loop to the north, Garth Avenue to the west, Stadium Boulevard to the south, and then Old 63 to the east. So it's a rather large encompassing area. If you remember from the previous slide, we got 4 substations that actually have feeder circuits into the area. We got the power plant, our Rebel Hill substation, our Grindstone substation, and our Hinkson Creek substation. And I'll kind of go back, and if you're looking at it as the downtown area being roughly in this vicinity here, we've got the power plant, Rebel Hill, Grindstone, and Hinkson, all the feeder circuits that come into the downtown area.
Can we buy the power that you were talking about earlier? Is it not correct to think that all comes to one place and then goes out?
No, I mean it comes to all of the places at once, and it goes to where it's needed as it's needed. And so, of the 20 distribution transformers, going back to the slide, there's usually 3 feeder circuits per transformer. Some of them have 4, but that's rare. So we have around 60 to 65 distribution circuits throughout the entire city. Their source would be the substation that they come from. That substation gets its energy supply from either the 69 kV level. If it's coming from the 69 kV level, that's coming from one of our substations that transformed it down from the 161 kV level. And then looking up at the 161 kV level, we've got the 3 major. We've got Perchy Creek, Bolstead, and Grindstone substations are our major interchange substations where electricity is delivered to us. You add it up, we've got 13 circuits that come into this downtown area from these various substations. I'll kind of go a little bit more detail. Here, of the 4 substations that feed the downtown area, 7 feeder circuits come from the power plant. 3 feeder circuits come from Rebel Hill. One of the Rebel Hill feeder circuits was just completed last year, and so it's a brand new circuit into the area. We've got 1 Grindstone feeder circuit, 2 Hinkson Creek feeder circuits. Ideally, we would like to keep each feeder circuit to around 7 megawatts of load. Maximum capacity for any one individual feeder circuit is 11 megawatts. But we typically don't want to operate at that. It'd be like, operating your car at its maximum speed. You probably really don't want to do that for very long.
7 megawatts is dictated by cable capacity. Your average capacity of the cable with a certain circuit.
It's actually related to the transformer. Each of our transformers is a 22 megawatt transformer in general. So if you've got 3 circuits, if you take 22 divided by 3, you get 7.
So it goes back to the transformation, not the circuit itself.
That's correct. We have 600 amp class circuits, and that's where the 11 megawatt comes from. As equipment gets older, you don't necessarily want to operate it at its maximum nameplate rating. Now, in doing our calculations to figure out how much load was in that boundary we were just talking about, maybe you would think we'll just add up all the load that's on those feeder circuits. Well, it's a little bit more challenging than that. One, not all of the load that particular feeder circuit is in the downtown area. And so what I've got here is any particular feeder coming into the downtown area, it varies between 90% of the load on that particular circuit being in the downtown area, or only 10% of the load being in that downtown area. And so what we did was we made an estimate as to what percentage of each one of those individual feeders was in the downtown area, and then assign that load, and then added up all those adjusted loads to come up with a total, which would show you here on this next slide. Actually, for that, this is a map of our downtown circuitry with all 13 feeder circuits. As you can see, you know, or if you can see all these colors, some of us color-challenged folks have a problem with the red and green ones, but, you know, there's pretty much some form of circuit on almost every street within the downtown area. Some important things to note in our distribution system, the feeder circuits terminate in a normally open switch. We've got 34 normally open switches within the downtown boundary. Along with those 34 normally open switches, we have 30 normally closed switches. And what this allows us to do is reconfigure in a rapid fashion how the downtown is fed from any one particular substation that feeds into the area. So, you know, if we have a problem with a piece of equipment in one area, we can open the open switches that would isolate that problem and close switches back to be able to feed power around that so that we can isolate the outage to as small amount of customers as possible.
They all SCADA control? All?
No, these would all be manual operated.
Manual operated.
And so what that allows us to do is it gives us a very large flexibility in how we serve loads within the downtown area. And in fact, this particular map is just a snapshot in time. You know, if we were to pull up this map next year, we'll probably have made changes to our normally open scheme so that the load is more balanced across all of our transformers and feeder circuits, not only in the downtown area, but in our whole distribution system.
And you can do that all over town?
We can do that all over town. So what is the loading in the downtown area? You know, going back to the 13 feeder circuits that come into the downtown area and calculating what percentage of each individual circuit, you know, what its load might be, either 10% or 90%, adding those up, we've come up for, you know, 2015 last year, when, you know, we haven't quite peaked yet for this year, but we estimated that there was a 67 megawatts of load into the downtown area across those 13 feeder circuits.
So that's based on metering of those feeder circuits, or is that just based on estimates of consumption?
We have instantaneous meters at our substation so that we can tell what the load is on the feeder at any one given time. We do not have instantaneous meters on the load that's throughout the entire, you know, we read your meter once a month. And that's like, you know, it makes it challenging to determine how much or how much demand. Some of the customers do have demand meters, but some of them do not. It depends on the type of customer that you are. And the demand meter doesn't tell us necessarily the date that it happened either. And so this is based off of our substation metering during our peak, so that we know that during our peak, on those particular 13 circuits, using the load factor, if you will, for each one of those individual feeders, 67 megawatts was in the downtown area. And then you might want to ask, well, what was the available capacity to spread across that? You know, if we were to max out those available capacity, that would be 77 megawatts, which would give us a spare capacity in the downtown area of somewhere in the neighborhood of 10 megawatts. That sounds like, you know, great, you know, but this is when everything is in service, right? You know, there's nothing wrong. Everything is working normally. All of our substation transformers are in service. There are no problems or outages. However, we've got to be able to plan our system a little bit better than that. You know, some of the equipment, especially like these station class transformers, they're massively huge. Most of them are in the 22 megawatt range. They weigh tens of thousands of pounds. They're filled with thousands of gallons of oil. When we do have a fault in one and it causes irreparable damage, it takes us, I think the last time we had one at Hinkson Creek go bad a couple of summers ago. It took us just a little over 32 days to get it taken out and the new one put in. We do have a spare to keep it at our power plant, but that's just how long it takes to move these things. It takes a couple of days just to move it from the power plant to where it needs to go. And then, you know, we have to unhook the old one and then rewire the new one in. So, you know, getting these things into place. So we want to make sure that our system is robust enough that we can the stand, losing one of these transformers can still feed all of our customers.
So how would both work?
Well, age, over time, they have a number of faults on the system, and each time a fault occurs, a tiny bit of damage occurs to that transformer. And so over the history of its life, it'll be faulted enough times that, it will, fail in some fashion.
So you can sort of plan for when to
expect. That's why we keep a spare.
Do those cost more than $1,000?
$1,001, just like the Price is Right, right? Actually, they do. They are very expensive.
Like $1 million.
They are about $750,000, I think, is what our last one cost.
You just have a spare layer?
Well, if we did, then another thing is the lead time to get this type of equipment. It takes over a year to get one. And so, if we don't have a spare, we just ordered it when we needed it, it would take us, it's taking us about a year of lead time to get these things because they're all custom made for that particular utility.
You might get lucky to find a used one that matches up. You might.
Custom made.
Yeah, because they are custom.
On exchange.
Yeah.
Well, believe it or not, utility companies don't like to play well together. When designing their equipment, back in the day, they designed their equipment so that it was incompatible with the neighboring utility's equipment, so that if you were a customer of my utility, it would be difficult for you to migrate to the other utility, and it would also be difficult for territories to migrate from one to the other because their electric systems are designed, they either operate at slightly different distribution voltages. I won't get too deep into it, but the phase angle at which electricity can be generated at, you can change it around so that the one distribution system isn't compatible with the other. And then there's the rotation of the system itself electrically. There are two different ways that it can rotate. And so...
They standardized phone chargers recently, didn't they? They haven't done that yet? Really?
No, Apple still has a different one, don't they?
All right, that was a bad example. Make any sense?
So I have a question. So the loading... So this is for specifically for downtown.
Uh-huh.
And we've got our 67 is our average load, or however you...
That's our max, calculated maximum.
Right. And then available capacity is 77, so our spare is 10. So how does that ratio differ from downtown to other different areas of the city? Is that a lot low? Is that 10? Is that spare capacity of 10 a lot lower than other areas of the city?
It's actually probably there are areas of the city, especially in the southern portion of our electric territory, that's much lower. Our electrical distribution engineers are very concerned, especially in the southwest area,
right,
of being able to handle the load growth without some improvements that we'll talk about here just a little bit. But going back, talking about being able to handle an emergency and still being able to serve all of our customers, we looked at our two worst cases. One of them would be the loss of a station-class transformer, kind of what I just described, having to move one of those large things, and each one of those station-class transformers feeds through distribution circuits. We did some modeling, and the loss of the worst transformer for the downtown area would result in us having to make up 6 megawatts from other feeder circuits within the downtown area. So that really gives us a spare capacity of 4 megawatts. But even worse than that, there are some critical feeders, and if we were to have a fire or something happen right in that particular feeder cubicle, which has happened from time to time. I think Greg was telling a story about a snake that crawled in and shorted out some circuits. That's possible. When it does that, it does some significant damage to that particular feeder circuit at its source. And so it takes us, some time to get it back. Sometimes it can be as little as a couple days, sometimes it can be a couple of weeks, just depending on the amount of damage. So we want to make sure that we can, keep everybody in service. So with the loss of the feeder, I believe it was one of the feeders out of the power plant, gave us 8 megawatts that we would have to make up from the rest of the surrounding system. So in the downtown area, if you're looking at trying to be able to survive your two worst case scenarios, the It's really only about 2 megawatts of spare capacity at this point in time. And this includes all load estimates of all the known new development in the area.
So it does include the current projects in construction?
It does, yes.
So is it fair to say also that the more dense an area, the higher the spare capacity you'd like? Or does density not necessarily play a role? Does that make sense?
You see, the denser the area, the higher.
I'm just saying, as opposed to downtown, obviously, is a denser populated area.
It is, but we could have high lows in non-dense areas, too.
Right, okay, I see what you're saying.
The density really, while it plays into a little bit, you know, density, higher the density, the higher the load's going to be, but that doesn't necessarily, high density equal higher load.
How does downtown fit into
the sort
of ratio of use?
If you look at our overall system, our system peak is 267, and you're fourth of it.
So reading this, you're really sitting on right now 2 megawatts of available capacity for growth.
That's right.
Any more than that, either another circuit is going to have to come in, and or transformation.
And we'll talk about what we've kind of got planned to handle that here in the future.
And some of the developments downtown, you need to know that you demolish a building and it has electrical load, and so you get rid of that load, but then you create a new load, and then so what's the difference between the two loads? It'd be the net increase. How's that working out?
Well, I'll cover that in just a minute.
Well, good.
Quit jumping ahead.
New customers. Very good segue into new customers. How do we handle the customers? One thing that I should point out is in 1988, the City of Columbia and the surrounding cooperative, which is Boone Electric, established a territory agreement. And that territory agreement was approved by the Missouri Public Service Commission. In that agreement, it states that the city shall provide electric service to all new customers within the electric service territory. Look at the map here on the right. That is our electric service territory. You might notice that the electric service territory is not synonymous with the Columbia city limits. There are areas inside our electric service territory that are outside of the city limits. And there are also areas outside of the electric service territory that are within the city limits.
So is that an agreement that will eventually get renegotiated, or is there the desire to have all of the city
within? We had the first agreement that was allowed by the Public Service Commission. It has a lot of flexibilities that newer agreements between cities and their cooperatives don't enjoy. And so we actually have a very good working relationship with Boone Electric. We work extremely well with them. There are clauses within our territory agreement that if for some reason we have facilities nearby and they don't, they will waive customers to us and vice versa. We've always had a good working relationship between us. I don't really see the need for doing that unless there's some kind of desire to make the city limits and the electric service territory match, but that's never, that would be an ever, forever moving line. And, I think that, will it ever be revisited? I'm sure anything can be revisited, but I would say that, it is very beneficial. The clauses that we have in there and the liberties that we have that other municipalities and their cooperative don't enjoy at this point in time, we would be subject to falling under those new regulations or different clauses if we were to revisit that. So if we were going to do that, I would make sure that we do it smart.
This is just an annexation question. So if the city annexes an area that would be on a Boone Electric service, at that point in time, does Boone Electric collect a pilot that goes back to the city, or the rate stays the same without a pilot tax? Pilot. I mean, you charge a pilot in lieu of tax.
I actually don't know that, do you?
I think when they are annexed, I think they
seem to be private off of the electric. Off the, like, off the, even if they're serving with electric. Because they live in the city limits at that point in time.
What do you mean by a pilot agreement?
Well, let me explain. It's a payment.
Pilot is a payment agreement. We're required, not required, but we charge a pilot. It's basically a tax, even though we're a municipality and don't really charge you tax.
As if it was
a revenue stream that goes back into the general fund as if it were a tax that we were collecting that a private utility would have had to collect in return to the city.
It's a percentage similar to a sales tax.
I see.
Tax.
Okay. Yeah.
By charter?
Yeah.
By charter?
Yeah.
And I'm assuming if it's Boone Electric, it wouldn't be a pilot because the pilot just applies to us because we're sales.
Right.
It's probably sales tax on the Boone
Electric. Yeah. We have a couple of ordinances that kind of guide us on how new customers are brought into the system. One is the availability of electric service. This is Chapter 27-87. Outlines the type of services that we will make available to customers, and so we don't have to provide just any service. We offer specific for residential type areas 120, 240 electric service at single phase. For commercial and three phase customers, it dictates that you must take service at either 120, 208, three phase, or 480, 277. And it also dictates that we only have to give service where we have it available, and if it's not available, then an electric extension will have to be made. And then Chapter 2788 gives us guidance on how electrical extensions to our distribution system are made. And you know, when customers develop where we don't have services available, Chapter 2788 dictates how we basically partner with them to get service available in the area. And the simplified version of it is they are required to put in the raceway system, and then we will come back after they've installed the raceway system and put in the conductor and the transformers that they will end up using to service either their facility or that neighborhood, if it's a new neighborhood, or whatever the new load happens
to
be.
The utility would pay for the cable and transformer.
We
but the raceway is all established by the development for the builder. And you pull the cable through, or do you have a contract?
We pull the cable through. That way we have control over the quality of that process. We do all the terminations in-house. We just want to make sure that, we're the ones that are going to have to end up maintaining that system, so we want to make sure we're the ones that are installed.
And the raceways are installed per your specifications?
That's correct. The raceway is basically a conduit system. It's something that we pull our cables through. They will install the raceway system to where predetermined sites for transformers will need to be. And then they will actually install the pads that the transformers will fit on. We'll pull our cables up into and terminate those cables in the transformers that we set up. Kind of looking at new customers as a whole and projected load growth. Going back, our load growth traditionally has been somewhere between 1% and 2%, currently experiencing right around 1.25%. This particular graphic was from community development and kind of highlights, challenging to see, but the darker the purple spots are, the higher potential there is for growth in that particular area. That's overlaid with several different things here. The yellow or gold area is districts where their new schools are developing, and so those are going to become magnet areas for potential growth. Also highlights some of the residential subdivisions that have gone in recently. As you can see, we have a high potential for growth in the southern portion of the city of Columbia. How do we go about facilitating these customers? New customers will have to come in and make a service application. In that service application, we'll make the determination if services exist in that particular area. If they don't, they will have to come in and file an application for extension of the electric system. And then they will, after that gets approved, They will make the cut. They will install the raceway system, and we'll come back and install our equipment at the end level. You know, how do we determine how much load a particular customer is going to use? During the building permitting process, they're required to submit to us riser diagrams and load calculations. These are useful, however, most customers often grossly overestimate the amount of electricity that they're going to need, especially on a peak basis. I think when this whole process all started, we had a bunch of developers that were wanting to redevelop in the downtown area. And they were coming to us and saying, you know, well, my project's going to need 5 megawatts of power. And we're like, oh my God, 5 megawatts for one customer? And it turns out, you know, at the end of this whole entire process, they're going to end up being like just a 750-kilowatt load. And so they often grossly overestimate what they're going to need. I can't really tell you that.
Bad assumptions.
Conservative estimating.
Yeah.
They have to follow guidelines that are put out by the National Electric Code that requires them to calculate, you know, how many kilowatts per fixture, appliance, you know, load center, things of that nature. When they end up summing all of that up, the problem is, rare is it that everybody turns everything on all at the same time. I mean, how often do you go into your house and turn everything that you have on? Probably never, right? But
depends if the kids are home.
But you know, the system has to be designed in such a way to basically almost allow you to do that.
Is it really? So it really is that simple. Those huge estimations are based on everybody running everything all at once.
Yeah. And a developer doesn't want to come in and say they're going to use this gross amount. That's what's required.
And so we, you know, based upon the type of building or structure it is, or the type of, we will scale that back to a more appropriate level and come up with an initial set of transformers for that particular facility. And so we'll put it in service and monitor it. And one of the things that we'll go over is how we monitor our system going forward.
So is there a commonly used formula or
depends on the type of thing, but like in the downtown area we've been calculating I think 5 watts a square foot.
And that's tied to some sort of industry standard or
that's been what our experience has been.
Okay.
We use empirical data as well. We find out that consultants in this industry build buildings and they grossly overestimate how much energy is going to need, and then we go back and look at the empirical data for similar buildings and come up with an estimate that's pretty close to exactly what it's going to use.
Right.
As Ryan says, not every circuit or device gets run at the same time.
Is the electrical system modeled?
We have several different models that we use, and that's coming up. Might even be absolutely net. You might be in mind.
For the distribution system, all new circuits that are not going on existing poles would be underground. Is that the practice right now?
Correct. There is some ordinance that required all new extensions to be made underground. There are some exceptions to that if for some reason, and these are distribution circuits, are required to be underground. Unless there's some extenuating circumstance that will require it to be overhead at this point in time. You know, I can't really think of what that might be, but just in case there is, you know, there would be that extenuating circumstance that would be overhead. Out of planning, how do we plan for our system? Long term, you know, 1 to 20 years, and these are for, you know, making substation additions. Do we need additional transmission lines? Do we need to bring on additional generation? Is there additional transformation that needs to happen in some areas? There's a lot of federal oversight in this particular area. You know, going back to, you know, FERC, Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, NERC, North American Electric Reliability Corporation, and MISO, all give us guidelines. NERC has developed standards that they actually enforce and can fine us for not complying with, and MISO has operational procedures that would require us to follow. We participate in planning groups in both of those, particular MISO and NERC, on an annual basis. We do integrated resource planning, and I'll go into a little bit deeper what that means, but we do that about once every 5 years. And then annually, as part of our participation in these NERC and MISO efforts, we do annual system studies that analyze power flow, short circuit, and stability in both the near-term horizon, which is in like immediately 1 to 5 years, how are you going to operate your system, but also in the long term, you know, how are you going to be able to make sure that you can continue to operate your system reliably in the 6 to 10 plus year time frame.
Is it fair to say on the integrated resource planning that it's updated every 5 years?
That's correct.
And the integrated resource planning, it explores demand side management as well as supply side.
That's correct. I got a slide out of here. Short term, looking more internally and kind of what we do on not only an annually basis, but maybe on a monthly or a weekly or day in, day out basis. We need to react to changes in load. We either have new or shifting loads, either through new customers, redevelopment, and customers don't necessarily, they can be a long-time customer, but their internal load can change dramatically from year to year as they bring in and out new equipment. And so, loads shift over time. If you would have come to me 10 years ago and said that, southern portion of your electric service territory is going to be where your new hot load spot is, I would have laughed at you. The industrial corridor was growing like gangbusters at that point in time, and I was like, we should be focusing all of our efforts up here. Now, because of the recession, several of those large industrial facilities and manufacturing plants have altered what they do, and the load has significantly dropped off of that area. New shopping, commercial, and school areas developing in the south has migrated all that load to the south. Annually, we do load and phase balance studies, and this is where we, going back to that, we'd like to have 7 megawatts on each feeder, where we try and adjust our normally open and normally closed scheme on an annual basis so that we can achieve that, so that our system is as equally balanced as possible. And going back, we do make changes to our normally open switches on our feeders annually. But we also got to enact through system anomalies that happen, all of a sudden. And these are, storm damage, an outage, either caused by animal, human, or some other. And so what we do, like I mentioned before, was what we try to do is isolate that outage to as small a group as possible. And we do that by operating our series of open and closed switches. We open up as small an area as possible around the actual problem, and then close everything back in so that everybody, the most people that we can bring back, we can as fast as possible. Allows us to work that outage and then bring those people back, and then we switch back the system to a normal configuration after we restore power. And we also do power factor correction on a seasonal basis. As the loads begin to rise on our system, we have a distributed system of capacitor banks that help us maintain not only the voltage on our system, but bar flow through our system. And we try to operate our system at a neutral power factor. And I won't dive too deep into that unless you really want to know what it is.
I do have one question on that. Do you have capacitor banks at most of your feeder substations each? Where are your capacitor banks located in the downtown area? Downtown area.
I don't have a map for the downtown area, but they're distributed all throughout our entire system. If you want locations in the downtown area, I'm completely
fine. I was curious if you had, have any.
I don't have a slide with me on that, but I can bring you some information on where our capacitors are. We typically try to stage them throughout the circuit, so we don't have any close in to the substation, but we try to get them towards the farther end,
towards the load,
back feed the bar through the system.
Yeah, I think all of our controls on the distribution system, and some of them are temperature control, and some of them are kind of SCADA control, or supervisory control. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the whole electrical system's tied into the SCADA system.
Got shot out here just a minute.
Do you have tap control on your transformers?
We do.
For your distribution system?
We do.
The distribution system has automatic tap control, and so as load increases, voltage will tend to want to drop. At certain thresholds, there are tap changers on our transformers that ratchet the voltage back up again, and so they automatically try to follow the voltage as best as possible. Integrated resource planning. This is where we try to balance the load with power supply resources. We have gone through several of these. Our most two current, we did a full-blown integrated resources plan in 2008, and then that was updated in 2013. Both were provided by Burns and McDonald. What this does is it analyzes our load projections going forward in the future, what potential power generation resources might be available to meet that load, as well as what can you do to shift that load so you don't need as much power generation going forward in the future. And so it analyzes different types of programs and what the cost to benefit ratio is for not only the supply side, but also curbing the demand side, and that shapes our energy management programs that we offer from five-year period to five-year period. As we move forward, the low-hanging fruit changes. It used to be adding insulation was probably the best low-hanging fruit. Now we're realizing that we do all kinds of load management things like air conditioner rebates to encourage you to get more efficient air conditioners. Weather sealing, energy things to get your house tighter. We have commercial programs that help you, rebates for HVAC type equipment, rebates for commercial lighting, try to swap out some of the older lighting in the areas. And so we try to do the best blend we can with minimizing the load growth with demand side, as well as meeting future load growth requirements with the cheapest power supplies possible. And we try to blend that to get the best portfolio moving forward from five-year period to five-year period.
Do you incentivize large power users to conserve? I'm thinking of the school district I drove by West Boulevard. When we lived there. And I asked Dr. Stiefelman, why are the lights always on at 10 o'clock at night?
They're eligible. Several of their facilities have gone through our CLIP program. There's HVAC programs they can go through.
So they have a lower electric bill, but do they get any sort of extra incentive?
We have different rate structures depending on the type, and each customer has to determine how best that they need to utilize electricity. Some customers are better at monitoring how they do that than others. We actually have an energy management department with key account specialists that will work with energy personnel, or even someone aside who isn't really an energy personnel, but we will try to help you manage your energy as best as possible. We have programs that will go in and do an energy audit. We have programs where we'll go in and infrared your facility and look for hot spots that may be potential areas that you either have equipment that's not operating or functioning properly, or getting ready to fail. We have programs where we will come in and analyze your. A lot of these larger plants have pneumatic systems, and we will do leak detection on that. And so there are a lot of programs that commercial and industrial customers can take advantage of to help them minimize their load.
They're also on a demand rate, which incentivizes them to reduce their peak demand financially.
That's correct.
Because they pay a lower energy rate, but they pay a demand as part of their rate. So
demand is your speedometer. So,
yeah. Ours is a residential rate. It's kind of like all built in. We just pay per kilowatt hour, but a larger pays a demand plus energy, so they have the incentive to to reduce their peak demand to the system.
But what about their overall use?
Well, their overall use really depends on the type of business that they are.
We worked with Stevens College years ago, some of their oldest facilities, and obviously not just us, but electrical engineers, and picked some of their worst spots, and they came in and they got some incentives for, obviously, some of the rebates paid for new fixtures, obviously just a percentage of it, but in turn, their bills are lower and their usage on the city as a whole is lower.
The system is so hard. They're on demand. The things that they can do to reduce their demand also reduce their energy year-round. Lighting, heating, right. Cooling systems. I mean, your air conditioner's not running at peak. You can save year-round with a more efficient cooling system.
Some of the modeling tools that we use. Forecast Pro is a forecasting tool that our rates department uses. It uses a best fit statistically based forecast with many, many inputs. Not only is it looking at trends from the past as far as load, but it also takes into account weather, load growth, economic, and a few other factors to come up with a best fit estimate on what the load projections are going to be going forward in the future. We use a product from Siemens called PSSE, and that's where we do all of our power flow, short circuit, and stability analysis on our system. We have a brand new energy management system, and that's our real-time monitoring and control of the electric system. We have operators 24 hours a day that are, watching the electric system, and it's capable of delivering alarms when there's a problem or an outage, or if certain areas of the city are, if there's a voltage problem or a current problem, it will alert them to that, and then they can make corrective actions as necessary. And then Strategist is a resource planning tool that is incorporated with our integrated resource modeling, and that's how they try and pair up the supply side, demand side sources for matching our load going forward out into the future. This is a screenshot of what the Forecast Pro looks like. As you can see, there's a vertical line kind of towards the right. To the left of that is a history, and then going forward is what the projection would look like. It kind of gives you a high case, a low case, and then a median case in the middle. And we typically forecast for that median case. Here's a photo of our brand new control center upstairs where they do the real-time power monitoring of the system. We have a 14-panel large format display that they can put up anything they would like. Right now it looks like they're currently monitoring the transmission system as a whole, as well as any alarms that have come in and some of our substation cameras. But then at each one of the desks, and we have two desks that look almost identical to this, they have multiple monitors which they have available. Some of them key into our outage management system, which helps us troubleshoot outages as they're occurring, so that when people call in, one house calls in, it says, hey, this house has power. When a block calls in, it says, hey, the particular fuse at this particular location is probably blown. When several blocks call in, it moves the problem down the line. So it helps us begin to troubleshoot the problems in the area. We've got our energy management system, which allows us to monitor at the substation level all of our breaker statuses, line flows. We've got several market tools that we watch. And then we've got our generation control program, which is basically our interface with MISO. And that is where they send us the instructions on where to have our generators, either to ramp them up or ramp them down. And so as you can see, they've got just a lot of information that they're monitoring 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. We have two of these control centers. One of them is here in this building, and the other one's at the power plant. One is a primary, and the other one's a backup, so that we have redundant systems so that in the event that something happens to this building, we can go to another facility
start it right back up and continue monitoring the system.
Is this your prime, the one in this building?
This is our primary one, yeah.
Yeah. Tell Tony he can't hide. I can see his gray hair.
So are outages mostly, like when you're talking about monitoring, you only know about outages if people call them in, or the program, there's some way for you to monitor and know when there's
outage? If the entire circuit is out, the circuit breaker will be open at the substation level and you'll be aware of that entire outage. If a single customer is out, you won't know that until it happens.
You may be talking about this in a little later slide, but are you moving towards automated metering?
And we have electronic lead technology, or ERT, for all of our current level. Yes, we will be migrating toward a more advanced metering system at some point in the future. When we get that installed, that will allow us to do some really interesting things. We'll know when you're out of power before you do. And it'll also help us be able to troubleshoot, because we'll be able to see the power outage evolve as it happens, as opposed to waiting for people to get feedback.
How do you expect that to grow from the large commercial customers, industrial companies, down to residentials?
We're actually planning on trying to implement a pilot on one of the feeder circuits here within the next couple of years. We're working on not only getting the electric system with the advanced metering technology. We also like the water system to be able to do that. And part of the reason for that is, it will allow us to capture both. It will allow us to capture billing data electronically instead of having a fleet of meter readers. So at some point in the future, we would like to evolve the meter readers into something different. They will be the ones that have to maintain. So having someone actually have to physically come by and look at some dials on your meter, those days were going away, but we'll need a staff of folks that are capable of troubleshooting and maintaining those electronic devices going forward in the future.
Are you to the point of thinking about whether there would be some sort of professional development to transition existing staff to new skills, or is it a different skill set?
It's a different skill set. We'll have to work with the Human Resources Department. Once we fully migrate the system, we'll probably need a blend over the course of our transition. We will probably do is figure out what the new job skills would be for this particular. Sure, it'd be a technician type. At what level, we'll have to work with the Human Resources Department. But as we grow areas out of the pilot into a more larger area, we'll transition the meter reading staff to a. More than likely, we'll grow them from in-house, so we'll train our meter readers to become whatever the new position would be.
You see, the power outage map, it's in the distribution building, Hutchin building, right?
We have the power outage map, what? I'm sorry.
Isn't it in the Hutchin building?
We have a map of the distribution system in three locations, in the Hutchin building, upstairs, and at the power plant. Okay. Our outage management system has an online function where it gets keyed from the input from the customers, there is a public portal into that so that you can look at that and see in real time what the status of an outage is, how large a particular outage is. It gives us internally some additional information that tells us what crew has been assigned, what the suspected problem actually is, and that will allow us to help make a determination of how long it's going to be. But as people become more and more dependent on electricity for everything these days, they are less and less tolerant of outages. The phones light up as soon as we have an outage. They want to know everything right then, because they're just so used to being able to do that on their phone or tablet or computer. They want to know what the problem is, when they're going to be back on. And oftentimes, we're just receiving that, like, okay, well, thank you for reporting. We often have to physically go out, walk the line, see what's either still laying across it, or what actually happened. And so, communication on how outages are managed is going to be key moving forward in the future. So, you know, one of the systems that we'll be upgrading with our metering system at some point in time will be our outage management system. The current tool we have where we have the outage app is going to have to evolve. People are going to want to be able to click on their house and come up with the information that, you know, all right, yes, my house is involved in this outage. They also, we're probably going to want the app. This is going to sound stupid, but one of the biggest things we get from the survey is they want to be contacted when they're in an outage. You know, it's like, okay.
Okay.
But they want a phone call, a text, an email, you know. Well, they might not be home. You know? So if you're not home, hey, it looks like I'm not going to have power back at home for another hour, so I'm going to hang out on that.
Hey, Greg, one of the things you asked about was the automating of our electric meters, and because our meter readers read water and electric meters, mm-hmm. we have to transition both those meters over. And so far, the water meters have been the more challenging to get into.
Yeah, same here. We
have a hostile environment to, as you know, to bury those things in the air right. and get them soaked with water.
Well, we're in the process of converting to full AMI. Of course, we have a lot fewer meters than you do, but all our electrics are already on AMI, and about half our steam and about a third of our water meters. And the water meters are a little more challenging, but we'll eventually get there. Where we'll be.
So to make that conversion and get our meter readers transitioned from the field codes to tech codes, we've got to transition water and electric together.
So how many staff are you talking about with meter readers?
Right, I'm on.
So are you going to talk at all about staffing issues that are more broadly, and how many outages or service calls do you tend to do a day? I'm sure it's seasonal.
I wasn't going to focus on that, but we can get that information for you if you'd like to see it. But I don't have it as part of this presentation. It's a screenshot of our brand new energy management system. As you can see, it's got, you know, from the transmission level, this particular shows a 69 kV, shows the lineup of transformers at the power plant, and at the bottom of the page here, these are the distribution circuits coming out of the power plant. It allows us to monitor, you know, voltage, current, power flowing through all of those devices as it's happening in real time.
Whose system is that?
OSI.
OSI.
Some future projects that we've got coming up. You know, Mill Creek Substation, I'm sure most of you are probably aware of the transmission project that we have in the southern portion of our electric service territory. We had purchased some property on Peach Court back in 2010, I believe, for the location of the new substation. Once we get the new substation completed, it would initially provide up to 56 megawatts of new distribution capacity, which would be assuming two transformers at the 161. And it would serve as a new load center for the southern region of our electric service territory.
How does that change downtown?
Well, we'll get into that in a minute. Peach Court is kind of located here. It's in the southernmost portion of our electric service territory.
Looks like a perfect location.
We are exploring different ways to power this at this particular time. We'll be back in front of council with a solution probably sometime later, or several solutions to them sometime later this year. And they will make the ultimate decision on
this,
that.
This is a controversial issue.
It was. We had a, in 2013, before that, but in 2013 we had our final public hearing, and they selected what was known as option A as the way to power the substation. Following that public hearing, you know, we went out for funding, and got funding, began the detailed design of that, got part of the way through the detailed design, and we had Julie Helson and another series of interested parties meeting, kind of outlining where our projected pole placement was going to be. That's when the hornet's nest, if you will, got stirred back up again. And there was a political effort to reinvestigate the project.
So So was there any new compelling evidence as a result of that that would make one change their mind?
At this point in time, I don't have any new compelling evidence that should make one change their mind.
Okay.
Assuming that we will get our new substation, you know, at some point in the not too distant future, we will be able to do several things. Like I mentioned, it's going to increase the load serving capacity by 56 megawatts. What that will allow us to do is unload several of the existing feeder circuits that are in the southern portion of our electric service territory. Our current plan is to unload two circuits from Gravelstone, two circuits from Kirchie Creek, and four circuits from our Hinkson Creek substation. This will allow us to redirect circuits from those substations to other areas of town.
Like downtown?
Specifically, I think we've got planned two feeders from our Hinkson Creek substation that we redirected towards the downtown area.
Yeah.
That would give us an injection of an additional 14 megawatts of capacity into the downtown area. And you know, we've been having conversations with the university. You know, their electric needs and our electric needs aren't. We have some similar needs moving forward in the future. The
university needs capacity.
So there may be a future for us.
Which is
in
the near downtown area as well as the city.
There may be a future partnership opportunity. What that might look like is a little premature at this time. But you know, we have a very good working relationship with the university as well. So
is there a time preferred?
We have some NERC compliance issues that we're going to have problems with. We don't have a solution somewhere in the early 2020 timeframe. You know, it really just depends on load growth and weather patterns. But you know, our modeling suggests that we'll have NERC compliance problems with transmission planning standards somewhere in the early 2020s.
So, and what happens when a community has NERC problems?
NERC has the ability to fine up to $1 million per day per violation. So, assuming that we only had one, it could be as $1 million a day times the number of days that you were in violation. Now, typically that's scaled onto the size of the utility. So, you know, what might be $1 million a day violation for an Ameren or a larger type of entity reduced for the city of Columbia as far as
it's a pretty big stick, probably. It also doesn't get to that point very frequently.
No, we try to stay on top of NERC standards as best we can.
Stay ahead of it. I mean, as you can see, the implementation time is extraordinary.
So how long would it take to get, if you got the green light, let's say tomorrow, to get this operational?
Fast track or, you know, what we would need. If we had to hurry, we could probably get it done in about 18 months.
And then normal time, twice that?
Yeah, twice that, 2 to 4 years.
Is any of the equipment that Mill Creek substation, has any of that been bought?
Yeah, we have, before the project was brought back in front of council for reconsideration, we had contracts with several different vendors for different types of material. We have transformers coming. I think we've got actually substation structures, equipment, and circuit breakers that we've taken possession of and are actually being stored at our Grindstone substation at this particular time. So assuming we get the 14 megawatts of additional capacity that we could inject into the downtown area, we'll revisit our load scenario. You know, again, for last year, we would have a load of 67 megawatts. Doing that available capacity with that fresh injection of 14 megawatts would bring the available capacity up to 91, leaving you with spare capacity of 24. But again, that's when everything's in service. Again, planning for those worst cases, we have to take a look at the loss of feeder and the loss of transformer. With the loss of feeder, we would have to make up 8 megawatts from the surrounding circuits, which would give you a theoretical spare capacity of 6 megawatts. In this particular case, the worst case is the loss of one of those station class transformers would actually be one of the loss of the station class transformers from the Kingston Creek substation at this point in time. And with that, we would have to make up an additional 10 megawatts from the surrounding distribution circuits. So that with the injection of the ejection of two feeder circuits from Kingston Creek, it would give the spare capacity of the downtown area approximately 14 additional megawatts.
So,
do you have an idea on square footage that would have typical space? Is that 14 megawatts?
Five watts a square foot.
Or you probably could you equate it per student?
Three students.
Three students. There you go, Greg.
So, with your projected growth rate, I know it's for the citywide, but when do we hit the additional two megawatts versus when do we hit the 14?
So 28 million square feet.
Then you're at the
plus space.
68.5 million square feet.
0.5 watts.
It's hard to say what's going on. Well, yeah. I mean, new developer could come out and say, it'd take all of it tomorrow.
If we don't ever lift the moratorium, I guess we wouldn't have to worry about it, would we?
There you go. 0.5 watts per square foot.
What's that?
0.5?
5 watts.
5 watts. Okay, so that's 2.8 million square feet. Of potential growth in the downtown region.
Big building.
So going forward and, you know, looking more further out again, you know, generation, what are our future plans for generation, making sure that we can continue to match our load with our generation resources? The 2013 IRP suggested that we might want to look at a partnership in a large combined cycle unit. We could possibly locally construct some natural gas-fired reciprocating engines or combustion turbines. Or we might be able to add an additional combined cycle operation to our Columbia Energy Center. There would also be the possibility that we're looking at of converting one of the older coal units at the power plant to burn 100% biomass.
Are those coal units used anymore?
Currently, the two coal units, one of the coal units has been completely retired, and the other one has been, lack of a better phrase, mothballed until the determination on whether it can be refueled to burn biomass is made.
So the power that comes out of the city power plant is really gas-fired?
At this point in time, all of our resources are natural gas-fired gas.
All resources in Columbia.
What's that?
All resources in Columbia, because you're...
At this point in time, yeah. All resources in Columbia are current.
Now, we do have some landfill gas generators, but that's not actually 3 megawatts worth of.
So the coal that sits out there is just residual stuff.
Look at me, DPA regulations.
Coal's gone.
In Clump.
In fact, we're working on a project right now that the ash pond that's behind the plant, we're working on remediating that back to a natural state.
Do you have a cost on that? What did that cost? Projected the cost.
Remediation?
Yeah. That cost
$2.7 million. Well, we're having to remediate that to comply with standards that involve coal combustion residues. So we'll be happy to clean it up anyway. We're also looking at, you know, renewable energy within the community footprint. Solar photovoltaic. We have a net meter program for customers that want to put solar panels on their house. We're also working on developing a community solar program for those people that either don't have the ability to put it on their house or maybe have another house that they rent that will allow them to participate in some solar energy. And there are a few customers that generate some electricity within the Indian Power. And then, you know, lastly, kind of ending my fly, kind of zooming all the way back out, you know, what future should we plan for? You know, the crystal ball, while we do our best to try and estimate and guess, you know, where we calculate where needs are going to be. The crystal ball is only so good, if you will. So
that's not very crystal ball, is it?
Well, if you can tell me where it did the actual crystal ball, you let me have your race and we'll go.
Let's see, Ryan. All your prior slides were inclusive of all the sources of renewable energy that the city has.
For what we talked about, yes.
Yeah. You didn't mention it specifically, but it's inclusive of all the renewable energy, which is not much, but it's
right around 7%.
Yeah, 7%. So.
What was it? Say that again. That's what our net, or what our natural reserve.
Out of the, let's see, Ryan, what it would be is out of the 330. No, out of the 260.
No, it's not calculated on a peak basis. It's on a
megawatt hour
basis.
Yeah, megawatt hour basis. So 7% of the total megawatts comes from renewable energy.
And that's locally produced or renewable energy purchased?
Both.
Based on your metric, it's five watt per square foot. You essentially got 400,000 square feet of available growth capacity in the downtown region until the new substation is constructed, fed, and new circuits are delivered to the downtown area. Is that about right?
400,000
square feet.
That's really not very much.
No, it's not. And one thing I learned recently, which really kind of surprised me, and it probably just comes down to economics for the new developments, but some of these new apartment complexes are all electric, heating with electric, which, you know, your demand really is in the summertime, so that's the constraint. So the heating is not usually a demand issue, but would it be a demand issue if there's more apartments going in all electric
for
wintertime demand?
We have not been a winter peaker yet.
It'd be shifting.
It could shift, but we're strongly a summer peaker at this point.
Right. But have you looked at the wintertime peak yet, and how does that compare with the summertime peak for electric?
It's about 75% of the summer.
So you're close. I mean, so you could conceivably, if all these complex apartment, dense phase apartments come in all electric, could shift where it's balanced or slightly.
Okay.
For multi-unit residential, how do our demand side regulations compare to other cities? Do we require
as far as our building code?
Yeah.
We have water and electric doesn't necessarily regulate the building code. It's my understanding that they've adopted a recent version of the international building codes.
12.
It's 12.
IBC 2012.
Now, go back to the residential. And, you know, on a residential complex like that, they're individual metered. Is that so? Each apartment complex has got an individual meter, so they're not going to be paying a demand rate. They're going to be paying a flat residential rate, which has no incentive for capacity. For demand production, you can get energy savings.
At this point in time, but one of the things we're actually looking at is implementing some form of
demand
rate across all rate classes. It's going to be a foreign concept to a lot of people, but demand and energy are two separate components of how electricity is delivered to you. Demand's kind of the speedometer. It's how fast you're going at any one given time. And the energy is the odometer. How far did you go during that course? Our new programs and things as we move forward into the future, a demand rate would help incentivize energy conservation as well as more correctly allocate cost of service across that particular rate class.
You're looking at a 2020 to early 2022 time frame for getting the capacity into the downtown region. If you're unable to achieve that, are we going to have a constraint issue in growth in the downtown area without some type of a demand-side management? Because 400,000 square feet of growth. Of course, it is net, so if you're going to demolish a building, you're taking the net. But you're going to have a limited amount of space that you can build.
That's right. We've never been in the position in the past where we've had to say no. And that's kind of new for us, if you will. We've always been allowed to expand our system to meet the demands of the customers. And so being so close is very uncomfortable for our electrical engineers that handle the distribution system. And so they're really counting on the fact that we'll get this 14 megawatts of fresh supply into the downtown area. If that isn't allowed to happen, I don't know if we can say no. We'll have to analyze what the agreement would, what our territory agreement actually requires. I do know it says that we shall provide electricity to all new customers in our electric service territory. And I guess the question is, that it doesn't dictate who has to pay for it.
So if the cushions and capacity you were talking about, that is controlled by the federal agencies you were discussing.
Our margin in generation capacity is the amount of margin that we have to keep on the distribution system. It's not. That's totally controlled internally. It's theory of, someone wanted to say 267 is it. You have to live with 267 megawatts. We would have to find a way to allow people to grow somehow only utilizing that amount of capacity. I don't know how long we can actually do that for. At some point, the matter how much demand side management you do, at some point, the number of customers that continue to grow, you're going to have to add more. I don't see how you can just cap it.
So one of the things that you probably saw in here, what Ryan's telling you here, is one of the big impacts of the settlement out is reliability. It indicated you plan to be reliable. So that's the first cost to us running up against the wire is electricity service is going to be a little bit less reliable because whatever that problem is, if we can't put the customers back on or fix it or maintain it, there's a lot of it.
Have you thought about capacity in the form of generation in the downtown area?
Distributed generation,
like diesel for peaking and all those situations. To maintain reliability in those peak situations, because the amount of peak time is very, very small. Most people are, most systems are 1 or 2% at their peak. And so you can just use expensive generation just to handle that short peak.
We used to have distributed generators on it. We still have some on our system, but the EPA is not making that easy.
EPA.
They're really restricting.
Diesel generators are extremely hard to permit now.
Oh, so you're talking about secondary.
Right.
As a matter of fact, I think the current rules only allow them to run if they're isolated and as an emergency and not tied to the system. So they have to go through it out each to get there and then come back there and it's off.
Right.
They can't run in parallel.
And whether they're running diesel or natural gas, because I think natural gas still has some of the constraints of the Rice Rule for EPA.
It is
the Rice Rule.
Right.
What's the Rice Rule?
Reciprocating internal combustion engine.
That's all the real question becomes, how prudent it is or to operate a municipal electric utility at those margins. It makes no sense.
It does make sense.
Well, and who should have to bear the outcome of less than reliable capacity?
Right, and it's Tracy. You you're talking hospitals, nursing. I mean, they're just silly to put yourself in a position that you would operate an electrical utility at that margins to put them in jeopardy. See, we've never had an ice storm.
So,
of any magnitude.
The availability of your distribution system within the downtown region, I think you mentioned there's multiple, seven?
13 feeders.
13 different feeders in there. So you feel that its current state is relatively robust enough for growth, but the issue is really getting capacity to that feeder system.
That's correct.
Is that, and you're looking at bringing that in at sub-transmission voltage, like a 69,000-volt system?
No, we bring in two 13.8 kV distribution circuits from Hinson Creek, assuming that they can unload Hinson Creek with
So just to clarify, the downtown building moratorium, that's for everything that is broken ground now is not included in that. If they haven't broken ground yet, they are. Is that right?
I think it's
there was a certain cutoff date.
What's that?
There was a certain cutoff date if you didn't have your plan submitted to the city.
Yeah, it's got to be broken ground. I said if you've gotten issued some level of building permit, I don't know what that is.
Is that something that we could find out and facilitate this discussion?
Oh, yeah, I'm sure we can get you the details behind what that is. I mean, the planning is managed the whole process, but they're easy to get what their interpretation of that is.
I'm just wondering if there are other projects that aren't really...
There are projects that will start that you haven't seen yet.
Okay, yeah.
The bonding approval you had for the 2015 expansion that included for the Peachtree substation, I think that's called Peachtree?
Peachtree.
Mill Creek.
Peachport's
the...
Right. Does that include expanding to the downtown region, or will that be another bond increase?
That's a good question. One feeder circuit included in that. So
you do have some funding already available for that. It's just getting the plan in place and getting it.
How favorable was the vote at that bond election?
That was pretty good.
70%.
Would you say it was the bond issue?
Uh-huh.
70%. It was up there.
For a bond issue. So in that 400,000 square feet, that would include, you know, beyond, right, so public school districts, you know, Grant School is where it's at, it could expand. We're literally talking about 400,000 square feet of capacity.
It's pretty constrained.
What's your opinion on the value of, I know we talked about it and have been mentioned, I think, about discounts for like net zero type developments. Is there any value to that? Like, is there really a reduction in the peak, you know, demand for that, or what's your opinion on that?
You know, net zero only nets the actual energy usage. It may not abate the peak. Now, certainly a net zero building is going to have a much lower impact on the demand than a non-net zero building. But it's net zero energy. It's not net zero demand.
Right.
Well, your peak so demand is not coincident with the solar peak.
What's that?
Solar peak occurs typically in the summer months about 12:30 to 1 o'clock in the afternoon. Your peak is later than that, like 5?
5 to 7, I would say. Yeah.
So by then the sun's coming down. So
it's about 30%.
Even a solar system on building would not impact it much, the peak demand.
Well, you're saying it would affect, it would be a lot less. But in the, not relatively, I mean, I'm not saying there would still be demand there. I'm not wanting to debate whether net zero is really net zero, but I'm just saying, do you think there's value to having discounts to try to encourage these net type zero, or is it really just doesn't affect you guys and there's no reason to discount?
Well, there's two. That's
a giant can of worms.
Yeah, I was going to say, dive into that one.
Well, it's really demand side management. How you achieve it, whether that's solar panels, or that's a generator, or that's turning off all the, or using different types of lighting technology.
Most of those benefits are on the supply planning side, because what you're doing is you're offsetting purchase of future power plants on this type of thing. So what we're talking about here is really a distribution plan. So there's two different animals that you're talking about here. One is the distribution impact, and you've got the whole global power supply plan. Most of the energy efficiency things, you offset the future capacity and power plant purchases. Doesn't mean you're necessarily saving distribution in that sense.
But they're both costs to you.
Let's see, did the council increase electric rates to pay for, didn't they increase the rates 2% to pay for the transmission project and the bonds?
Yeah, The bond was issued with two sales off of it. We sold the first increment, and it was a 3% increase.
3%, okay.
The second half has not been sold.
Second half has not been sold.
With another anticipated 3% increase at that point.
It's two and one.
Okay.
It's 2 1 year and one the next year.
Well, we are getting very close to 9 o'clock. Do we have some other questions for Brian and Tad?
Do you see any, like, as far as the federal regulations and NERC and ESO, I know you said you're coming up to some standards you're going to have to meet in 2020, but what are the costs of these type of things? Are they going to need another bond issue? Do you generate enough revenue from just the rates to pay for these as they come along, or do you just not know until they come along?
Most of the large dollar items will be associated with like a transmission or substation type project. We do enough planning effort, like I mentioned earlier, in the 5, 6 to 10 plus year time frame that we know, when we estimate to have problems of that order of magnitude. More recently, the one that caught us probably the most off guard, if you will, was the change in the cybersecurity standards. We got our system turned on the day before it was required.
Is it like being on it if you're like, as long as you're working towards it, they'll just let you string them along for a while, or is it pretty much pretty hard and fast?
There is a line in the sand. It's a lot like working with the Department of Natural Resources, and then you do have to come up with a mitigation plan if you're not compliant, and then work with them on how you're going to get compliant. But they will find you, and us.
They certainly are regulated, but they're regulated.
They're trying to migrate away from just straight up monetary fines, shame on you type of thing. They would rather work with you to help you be more reliable, and then go through what's known as their fine, fix, and track. If you're honest with them, you come forward and say, "Hey, we're having issues here, and this is what we're trying to do to get it fixed. We're just going to need this amount of time." They're usually pretty willing to work with you on trying to get that and run it through a fine, fix, and track, as opposed to, we're going to come down and drop a $1 million a day fine on your head. Now, that being said, if they come in and find something, they would prefer that you find it yourself and report it, as opposed to, come in, audit you, and find something that looks like you've been trying to hide.
One of the biggest fines, and they actually have the fines that the biggest published fine, is if you have an outage that after the investigation is caused by a compliance violation, you're going to get sick.
Well, wasn't the advent of the control rooms a product of...
It was.
Yeah.
They changed the emergency operations requirements.
Yeah.
We had to build a second control center as part of that.
Right. The training of operators, too. Yeah.
Training of operators. There are... We are registered for 7 different functions within NERC. We're a balancing authority, which requires us to be able to match our load and generation resources. We're a transmission owner who physically owns assets above 100 kV level. Transmission operator, we physically operate transmission. Because we're a transmission owner and a transmission operator, we're required to have a transmission planner where we make sure that our portion of the transmission system is planned according to their guidelines, through those different time periods that I was talking about. We are a distribution provider, we have end use customers that we service, so there's some standards with that.
Ryan, would it have benefit to touch upon TEA just a little bit?
Sure. TEA is our market participant in the MISO energy market. They have energy marketing expertise beyond what we can recruit and retain here in town. They have a 24-hour day operation. They're based out of Jacksonville, Florida. And what they do is help us market our power and load resources into the energy market as efficiently and effectively as possible.
However, they service
the public service sector only.
Yeah, public.
So while they are private company, they cater to the public service sector.
Not a major issue, but are you getting pressure, or at least do you have plans in place to put EV charging stations in the downtown area off your system?
There's been some discussion of that. I don't know how much pressure. We haven't observed a whole lot of pressure or requests for that particular type of infrastructure. Certainly planning for electric vehicles is something that we're working on. We actually purchased an electric vehicle as Water and Light last year to begin doing some experimenting with it, if you will. The city as a whole is beginning to migrate towards an electric fleet. I believe they have a couple of buses at this point in time. And they're slated to get several more, I believe, this upcoming fiscal year. And they're wrestling with the demand portion of that. If they were to plug all their buses in all at the same time and charge them,
Electric vehicles helping the problem.
In the
both are going to help.
The Short Street parking garage that there was conduit put in
The other question to tie to that: do you see the developer may come in, like an apartment complex developer, and put in EV charging stations and want to sell your electricity to their
customers?
There's
actually ordinances that prohibit.
Yeah, they can't.
You have an ordinance in place to prohibit
that. Yeah, they can't do
that. Can't resale electricity. Okay. Now, that would not necessarily prevent them from putting in a charging station and charging you $5 an hour to park in a spot.
Yeah.
So that's something that could be fixed by an ordinance, too.
I'm sure there are ways to deal with that. The resale of electricity is the big one. That you can't just buy power from us and then resell it at a certain rate. Now, as fast as we could evolve an ordinance to deal with certain things, they could probably.
I know some entities have put in EV charging stations in areas, and Kohl's is a good example. And they give the electricity away for free. If you go in there and shop.
Right.
You go in and shop in their store.
They are making they are getting their money or revenue off of that spot in a different fashion.
Right. You got to certify that you went in and shopped. I don't get to buy it from them. Just got to check getting their money. So it's high as for customers.
So the whole electric vehicle thing, kind of cuts down the statement that's on the screen. You try to keep track of that. That could be a game changer. But how much are you playing for? How much integration are you playing for? How fast?
Albuquerque, New Mexico is a surprisingly robust parking utility.
We're looking as well on the university. We had inquiries, but not enough to make the point of going forward to start putting it in. Parking structures. So I think and there will be some kind of a rate structure set up to charge back the consumer for that electricity.
And the electrical department is somewhere between $125 million and $130 million enterprise.
When you switched to the new metering system, would it enable you to charge different rates during peak hours versus non-peak hours?
Absolutely.
So the electric vehicle thing, that could be an incentive to, charge at night,
but
it's
on peak hours. We don't necessarily have to wait for those to do that. We could incentivize things, get a separate meter for your electric vehicle charging station. Mm-hmm. And that only allows you to charge during a certain 3 to 5 time period.
Yeah, those are time of use metering and off-peak charging. I actually have something in the West Coast right now that are off peak rates that we encourage you to use in the night during the day.
Other questions from the task force?
Is there any other specific issues or recommendations you'd like to see come out of this task force, either of you guys, that you see as something we need to look at or comes to mind other than what we've talked about, or just if you want to emphasize something we have talked about?
Well, we can think about that offer and bring you back anything that comes up. And also, you guys, if there's information, that Ryan alluded to some studies and plans and stuff we've done, we can teach you anything we have.
Just put an electronic copy up on our website as a PDF or something. And can we also get a copy of the
PowerPoint?
Absolutely. It's already planned in the PowerPoint. We can put on there if it was in there. Plan.
The only thing I'll have to update, if you'd like to see, we'll load that off. I'll have to put the picture of the distribution system off the wall with the resolution on that.
Okay.
It's not typically something that we just share with the public as well.
Right. Okay. Maybe a higher quality of that. 1979th Street program.
That was cool.
Thank you. We've got an old business item, but in respect for our staff folks' time, if the public has any comments about the presentation, can we do those now?
Sure. Yep. Oops. I sat too long, but. So, my first thing, and I'll try and be quick, is now I know why it's so valuable to have all that fiber optic underneath the city. That's all linked to all these transformers. It may do something for the water, but that's the only thing that is giving you these options with the switches, all of those kind of things. So I knew it was big, but until I heard you kind of describe the level of control and the information feedback, you know, it didn't quite strike me. Of course, I hope to have, you know, basically broadband become a utility. But even before that, I can understand how big a deal that is. I guess I had a couple of comments. Greg, you said something about, well, we've got this 2 megawatts of, in the worst case scenario downtown, for basically allowing for square footage expansion. That was 2 megawatts out of 77. It didn't seem to me to be like a prudent margin. I was wondering in the IRP and these kind of things, on the projections about solar power and maybe the distribute, is that calculated back into as basically a power source? It may not be big enough to make a difference yet, but when you're talking about that power generation side, is it figured back into that, or is it get netted out someplace so you can't see it?
Our integrated resource planning does make projections for where the energy is coming from. Obviously, those type of resources are more of an energy impact than a demand impact, and they forecast those separately.
Okay. Because, I mean, I always think eventually the demand side thing is the virtual power plant, and that maybe it might be used to continue to think about it this way, but also just think in terms of, since it's something about controlling usage, but it's also kind of reducing the amount of capacity. Again, about the downtowns, and I heard the talk about if we got the 14 megawatts and so forth with the Mill Creek and this coming in. See, I'm not much interested in how much more building capacity downtown, especially when I hear there are real reliability issues and things about the Southwest. In terms of a lot of things, I'm thinking maybe not all of that those feeders should go downtown. It may be better to use some of that increased power and the feeder lines to really build up the redundancy and the reliability for the whole city. Of course, I'm always very interested in who's going to pay for that. And I did notice that I remember was it a year ago that we voted on the electric thing?
April of 2015.
If I remember reading all that, actually a lot of it was, well, so much of it was bonds, but the plan that was put forward and the rate increases said, and I can't remember the percentages, but you might provide them to everybody later, of the capital cost was anticipated to be funded actually by rate increases that were not like just for debt service. And there was, you had to balance some rationale for that. The group might find it very useful to hear about that. I heard about the electric cars, but in terms of, in particular, the solar and so forth, where does what is apparently a more rapid development of storage battery capacities, the idea where you can basically generate during the day, and it's not basically you're not so much going to be as much interested in peak demand, because in fact, if you've got this stuff, you can store things, and that's not a big deal now, but apparently it's getting, people are thinking about these aluminum kind of things. So in the next 10 or 20 years, the ability to generate at non-peak times, all this kind of stuff, and for people to store, is that so small now it's not yet in the various models?
They're starting to put together utility-scale storage projects, but there's not economically viable yet.
Well, I was thinking about distributed storage at people's houses and so forth, but I was just thinking about kind of it's, you know, in the next 10 years, it's being a factor in the models, both in terms of demand side and figuring out the cycle during the day about peaks and so forth.
I can't give you a good crystal ball on when energy storage is going to be a...
Well, I wasn't thinking about asking that. I'm actually thinking about it's being in the models so that even if it's small now, at whatever rate it grows, it's in the models, and if it begins to accelerate, it's actually going to be in the models and not just an afterthought. Very, very useful. Found it very, very useful tonight. Thank you very much.
Thank you. All right. Thank you guys very much. That was wonderful. So on our old business, and based on the hour, what would you think about individually sending me your thoughts on items 1 and 2? I will create a document. We'll make this our first new business item next week and have at least part of the work of it done, that will still require some discussion. And just as sort of a related report, I did get to talk to the mayor a little bit about our timeline, and he's comfortable with us. He's comfortable making the recommendation that we extend for a couple months so that we can get some get our work done, including some feedback from the public around our specific recommendations. When the task force was, the ordinance was put together, there was an interim report requirement in it that the timeline has come and gone on. So his request to me was that we put together a brief interim report, including recommendations on a finish-up timeline. So I would also like to submit a draft for discussion for next week on that, if that would work out.
Like you're going to write the draft?
Yes.
Would we find, we talked about this a little bit last time, would it be prudent to come up with a format for the report?
Yes.
So, because we're at the point now where we still have some recommendations to work through on sewers, mm-hmm. some possibly more with the electric side, but
right.
we're going to be a lot into report writing
right.
at this juncture.
Yeah.
So it's good to start with a structure or an end in mind.
Right. So I'll include that in the draft for the interim report. I think that'd be a good place for them to look at that too. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Kind of like a executive summary? Not quite about.
More asked to focus on the remainder of our process and an okay. update on what we've accomplished so far, less okay. about immediately reviewing draft recommendations. But covering the format of the report will be appropriate for sure.
So we got meetings scheduled through August, so we're probably looking at a completion time in October. Is that mm-hmm.
the... And then they'll use the interim report to discuss the expansion. Okay. Next week, we had decided that we weren't going to go back to sewer until the following week, so we want to follow up with our old business carryover in a discussion of tonight's presentation in terms of generating some initial recommendations. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, I think we got enough to talk about for sure with the development fee thing,
yes.
The report to council, our report structure.
Yeah.
Yeah, this stuff.
And also, John, these are your recommendations that you sent me to ask us to discuss. So I just wanted to give them to people to have a chance to look at.
They own sewer?
Have to do on sewer.
Yeah, they're having sewer.
Let's see, Chad, in regard to sewer, last night in the council agenda, there was an item of sewer rate. What was it?
Well, if it was on there, was we were setting the public hearing. We have to set the public hearing of sewer rates 30 days opposed to the rest of the budget items to setting the rates. They're only in, so we had to introduce the council. This council meeting, the next council meeting, the rest of the utilities are setting the rates for the public hearing.
So what's driving the sewer rate increase?
It's the annual, just the annual budget.
Yeah, it's the annual budget. That information will be in the budget when we go to the public hearing.
And I still.
That's a bond associated with that.
And I still. have a little. It's a little fuzzy still with me as to where we are as the Mayor's Task Force for Infrastructure for Stormwater and Sewer versus the effort that's going through the integrated management plan in the department, which is inclusive of stormwater and sewer. And that's why I put on there, it seems that we ought to revisit David Sorrell's letter to see how our work and their work is connected and it gets transferred, or I don't know.
I'm still a little fuzzy myself.
And I kind of took it that that's a long-term deal. They're going to incorporate our recommendations into their ongoing planning type process. And yeah, I mean, we're looking at the same stuff, but.
Okay.
I just was giving you how I looked at it. I mean, yeah, we're definitely looking at the same stuff, but from two different eyes, and we're part of the public, and that's a private report type thing that includes public comment.
Yeah.
All right. Anything else? Okay. Any other comments by task force members or staff? All right, thank you.